Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. In Acts chapter 15, the apostles gave four prohibitions for new Gentile believers: idols, blood as food, meat from strangled animals, and sexual immorality. What we'll see is that was a starting line for holiness, not a finish line. Explore how these prohibitions and goal come from Leviticus 17 to 20 and Amos 9. Discover how these house rules fit with Peter's vision of the sheet in Acts 10 and Paul's instructions for Christian living in Ephesians 4 and 5. Find out how the prophecy of Gentiles called by God's name and Bible instructions for mixed seeds and fabrics, honest speech, justice, and love your neighbor as yourself are central to walking as a holy people in a divided modern world.
Those of you who've paid super close attention over your lifetimes, you'll notice a few fundamental details that are being described here in our Torah portion. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not that everything in Leviticus 17, 18, 19, 20 all fall into the exact same categories, but they are very heavily related. So I write some categories on the board behind me. Those of you who know your Christian texts very well, you're very familiar with them. But write it down anyway, just so you're familiar with them, what we're talking about today. So further right up here, I'm going to idols. Okay. I'm also going to write my next word, which you're familiar with, is strangled. Strangled. I have blood. And I have sexual. I also happen to divide this out for category top to bottom. So I have beneath that, I have a Shabbat and Moses. Most of you are familiar with your New Testament scriptures. You're familiar with why these are all grouped together because of the apostles. So I'm grouping these together and I'm bringing them up today because if we actually let's first, before I go into our Torah portion, let's read a little bit about the apostles, how they grouped them and why they grouped them this way, and what we're talking about and why it's so relevant to Leviticus 17, 18, 19, and 20. So jump to your book of Acts, please. Now, the book of Acts in chapters 15, there's a section we're going to read and we'll talk a little about this before we see how or what the apostles were thinking when they applied this section. So Acts 15, we'll start out in the entire chapter necessarily, but I read a portion of it. So starting out in verse 18, I'm going to read this. So Acts 15, verse 8, it says, now, this is regarding, we're jumping into the middle of a conversation, by the way, a conclusion, a reason or argument, okay? This is, these are all the various history of the people and such. Let's back up a little bit. Let's start with James' address. So let's go to verse 13. We'll start verse 13. After they had concluded in silence, James answered the men, saying, men and brethren, listen to me. Simon, referring to Peter, has declared how God at the first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. And with this, the word of the prophets agree as written, after this, I'll return and rebuild the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. This is Acts 15. And I'll rebuild the ruins and I will set it up so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord who does all these things. So pause there for a minute. Note that was brought up with Amos chapter 9 as well. Verse 18. Known to God from eternity are all his works. Therefore I, James is speaking, judge that we should not trouble those from among the Gentiles who are turning to God, but that we write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols, sexual immorality, from things strangled, and from blood. For Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Shabbat. So, then they write the letter and distribute it amongst the various peoples as far as what they've concluded. So I'm bringing this up to you because when you read those statements, idols, you know, sexual morality, blood, strangled things, we have a picture in mind of what those are. You can probably imagine what they may be. Well, our imagination is not necessarily what God said they are. So, for example, we may have sexual morality. We can think of a few things. Oh, cheat on my spouse or whatever. Well, if you look from Exodus 17, 18, 19, and 20, you'll see that there's a whole lot of sexual immorality being listed there. All different forms, different types, different categories, different subcategories. All of those are sexual immorality. It's not one or two. You've got dozens listed as sexual immorality. So when we cover these topics in our book Leviticus, in particular those four chapters are most focused on it, you will note the majority of the items in those four chapters fall under these categories. Idols, strangled or something related to animals, blood, and sexuality. Those are majority items in those sections. So what it tells most individuals who've read this, most scholars who've talked about this for many years, is that the apostles, when they're listing these few four categories, they aren't talking about themselves, just blood alone. They're Jews. They know the Torah. So when they're talking about the idols, strangled things, blood, and sexuality, they're thinking about the Torah's definition of what those are and everything in that definition. Okay? So when I think of blood, we think, oh, well, don't drink the blood. Easy, right? No, don't eat blood. Well, actually, they have a lot of lists about just blood. They example, eating over blood, eating blood, anything that's not eating it, consuming it, but consuming something that's near blood is also inclusive of abstaining from blood. So we also have idols. Anything that's offered to idol, anything that has an idol's listed name, or Leviticus points out, mentioning or talking about if alternative God, thinking about an alternative God that exists is also idol worship or idol focused. So all those things are inclusive of idols. There are a lot of things too that also include of idols as well. So when we discuss these issues, the apostles said, this is my condition or our conditions we put upon Gentiles in order for them to show up at Shabbat. That's to show up at Shabbat. They're required to do some basic fundamental things. Because when they're at Shabbat, as the apostles listed, they will then learn the laws of Moses every week. They'll learn everything else. That's the point. So they're requiring Gentile new convert Christians to do some basic requirements that we list as obvious. Don't sleep with everything that walks, essentially, right? and don't eat bloods, don't eat around it. Blood is a contaminated item. We don't consume things near or around blood, obviously strangled items and sexual and idols as well. Yes, Yosef? He's asking if I said, oh, right, names of idols. Ah, great question. Right. So he's pointing out, what about the names of idols? Well, names of idols or names of gods are listed in the next section of our Torah. And he's asking about the names of our months and weeks. They're all derivatives, or most of them are derivatives of various pagan gods. That is actually an inherent flaw in the English language. You'll note in Hebrew languages, being biblical Hebrew prior to modern day, they use terms instead of, like, for example, January being the name of a month, it'd be month number, when are in a Gregorian calendar, month one, month two, month three, month four. You will note when we write dates down, like for example, today's date, 7/18/26, right? We read the dates. That's how Hebrew would have written down dates and named things. The month, well, they wouldn't necessarily put the month and day first. You could argue whether the day goes for the month or not, but that's how it would have written. So it would have originally not been names, but we have English language, which is not Hebrew, not biblical Hebrew, that is. So we actually, unfortunately, have adopted paganized names for things. But the idea is, the principle is, to when you focus on idols, or the idea of idols, is your thought process is not upon idols, or that they are real or functional things. So they are real demons. Yes, follow-up question. Is it wrong to say these names of month? I would argue in our English language, no, it is not wrong to say the names of month, because we would have the hard time saying day three. Day three of what? A day three of the month, day three of the week, we had a hard time, we'd be confused. So in our language, in our modern language, we unfortunately are stuck with that problem, and I do not have a solution. I'm not a miracle worker. I don't run languages of other cultures or even our own. Yes, Lorraine, you have a follow-up question. Michael Rood does do that calendar that way. You're right. He does write a calendar up. Those of you who are familiar with Michael Rood, he does attempt to make a calendar that uses numerical values for the names of the days of the week as well as the months to avoid the paganology terms in English. And more power to him. I have no problem with that. It's super hard to follow, unfortunately. I try to look at his calendar like, holy cow, what day of the week is this? I'm not sure which month it is. It's a little complicated, but not impossible. But the point being, the whole way we bring this up is because these four categories that are Gentile Christians, relatively new converts, get expanded on by Paul in Ephesians, which was just read. You will note that in Ephesians, Paul lists things in chapter 4 that was read, as well as the following chapter 5, which we didn't read. He adds to this list more complexities, more difficulties on Gentile Christians. But in Ephesians, he's not talking about two new converts who've been in the walk for a little period of time. I don't know how long. Could be years, could be months, I'm not sure. But some period of time, they've been in their walk and following the laws of God as best they can. And he then adds to it. Well, now you've been in the walk, everybody. Now there's more stuff required of you. So he adds more to it. It gives us the understanding mindset of the apostles that they were asking, not that this is the limitation, meaning accomplish these four things and stop. It's accomplish these four things as your starting point, your step one. Get your step one. And then as Ephesians explains with Paul, he then adds to it. Now you're going to add more to those steps. There's more things to do now that you've walked through and mastered the basic requirements of getting there. So the whole point of bringing this up is because I want you to understand inside a Jewish thought process, in Messiah's day at least, the apostles appear since they grouped all these four together, which is very convenient because they happen to be all grouped together in Leviticus 17, 18, 19, and 20. It implies in the Israelite mind, when the apostles were talking about this, they were talking about, hey, Gentiles, pay attention to Leviticus 17, 18, 19, and 20. Here is your starting point. Here's your step one, your beginning place. So let's go to Leviticus now. That's what I want. So it's to me, I think, I believe, I could be wrong, I believe it's relatively important to put things into perspective when speaking to or about Gentile Christians or Jewish Christians, as far as what the requirements were, what they were expected, and what is the conditions or ideas that are being translated in our Bibles. So we're not going to cover obviously 17, 18, but Leviticus 19 that's what we started reading out today. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy for I, the Lord, am holy. Now, pause there for a minute. When we think of the term holy, we think of some people, maybe not everybody, think of some ideal or a concept of, you know, greater than or holy or perfect in some capacity. The idea, of course, is that we have risen up from something that was gross, muck, dirt, whatever commonality, to be less common, which is correct. We have to be less common, not so ubiquitous. So the idea is that when we go through these lists of these items of required things to do that is expected of us, you'll note that they are action-based things. These are not necessarily just thought-based items. They're core is action-based. So we deal with God saying, you'd be holy because I, God, am holy, or I'm supposed to be holy because he's holy. All those things, it's action. What do I do that distinguishes me from common versus not common, right? That's the idea of being holy. So God's expecting or desiring us to be set aside as unique or separate in order to be like him. So in verse 3, every man, your mother and your father, you shall revere, and my Sabbath you shall observe. I am the Lord your God. Pause. Okay, everybody, my kids, the audience and such. He just tied revering your parents, as well as juxtapose those to Sabbath observance. List your parents. How many parents do you have? Take a wild guess. Two. Good guess. You got two parents, right? A mom and a dad. Whether they're with together or not, doesn't matter. You have two parents. But who is the third parent in this storyline? God. God's your other parent. It's important to understand that you are only biologically the parent, child of your parents, but you are his child. So when it comes to raising you, whether you're an adult or whether you're a child, same principle, who is actually raising you? Well, when you're little, your parents are raising you. They're the ones who, you know, change your diaper, feed you. They do the basic, here's an instruction, what's right and wrong, that kind of thing. You are learning along the way. At some point in your life, that transitions away from parent raising you to parent usually advising or suggestion or giving you encouragement or whatever it be as you grow. Right? You all have experienced that in your life. Decisions that you have to make, I have to make, we all have to make. Our parent isn't there holding our hands. They may like to be sometimes, but they're not. They're holding hands. So what happens when your parent isn't physically there and you make a decision, good or bad? Who was always there? Your God is. So who is the ultimate parent for you? Because eventually your parents will pass away, right? They die. And who's left? Well, you and God, right? So when it comes to parenting is concerned, biologically, physically, yeah, your parents. So God is a tie. You revere your parents. You revere the ones you can touch, feel, communicate with, talk back to, unfortunately. Have your conversation with your parents. That is what you can feel and touch. God, you don't get to feel and touch. It's not when you see. That's when you can hold on to, right? But he's still your parent for the balance of your life, however long that happens to be. So when it comes to we revere our parents, I find it interesting that God is also tied or juxtaposed that right next to or combined it in with, you could argue, with Shabbat observance. Because what are you doing on Shabbat? Are you observing Shabbat for your parents? No, you're not. Your parents may not even observe Shabbat for all you know. I don't even know who your parents are. But the point is, they may or may not. You aren't observing Shabbat for your parents. Who you're observing Shabbat for? You and God. It's a relationship between you and God. It's a connection between you and God. So God is pointing out in this juxtaposed example, tying parents and his observance with you, his relationship with you, as grouped together. Does that make sense? So that's where we fall under these identifying categories. I know they sound weird, but that category falls in the idol category. So God and parents. Oops, I can parents. It all falls under the Shabbat category. So God and parents. So God has tied them as, I always put an idol because you live one God, not others, right? Now, in the next verse, do not turn to idols, verse 4, and the molten gods that you shall not make for yourselves, for I am the Lord your God. That's why we tie it to the idol category, because he said, hey, it's me, nobody else. So it's pretty obvious how that one falls under. Continuing on in verse 5, when you slaughter a feast, this is a piece of shalom offering, Shalemim offerings, a feast, peace offerings to the Lord, you shall slaughter it to find favor for yourselves. On the day you slaughter it, you shall be eaten. On the next day, and whatever remains till the third day shall be burned in fire. But if it is eaten on the third day, it is rejected. It shall not be accepted. Each of those who eat it will bear his iniquity, for what is sacred to the Lord has he desecrated. And that soul will be cut off from his people. So in this category, you have it's not an idol worship, but it has to do with the feast peace offerings, which you're giving to God. And it actually also falls in the idol category. So offerings. Now, why does it fall in this category? Because remember, he's trying to make you holy, because like he's holy. This is separate from being like all the other idol worshiping people, groups that you live around or are around. What they may do with their offerings could last for however long it's going to be. And of course, God points out the nation I'm extracting or getting rid of and putting you in their place have been doing these things and disgusting. So they do these things to their own gods. So say, hey, we're not going to, don't do these things to me as your God. I have a question for you though, to think about. Notice he listed the feast peace offering, which is the one which we, it's like a big barbecue type of thing, which we all get to participate in. When you think about the offerings of God, you may think of others as well. You've probably heard of the burnt offerings, right? Or the grain offerings, or face of their offerings, or even sin offerings too. How come he didn't list those? Why did he just list the one? He didn't increase or add and say, well, all your offerings. Oh, why should I care about the other offerings too? Don't they matter? Well, theoretically they do matter. But there's a huge difference between the peace offerings, which are done at feast times or other activities in your life, compared to the others. Okay. And one of the big differences, it's you. You eat, you participate, you consume part of this offering. So I'll give you a hypothetical example. Let's pretend you're a farmer, a rancher, whatever you got. You got animals, okay? Let's pretend you have animals. And you're living way back when. And you're hungry. Your whole family's hungry. So you know what? I'm going to have a party this weekend. I'm going to bring everybody up and slaughter some animals. What am I going to do? Because that's what I'm going to do. Maybe there's some reason, maybe some excuse, whatever. I've got some excuse. And I said, I'll go and offer something to God too, so he'll bless it. And we'll throw an animal in there for there and call it good. And we'll just all have a good time. Are you really focusing your peace offering, which is your communication, eating with God, focus upon God in that instance, or focus upon your family and the party you're going to have? Well, theoretically, the family and the party you're going to have. You're worried about who's going to bring the salad, who's bringing the mashed potatoes, all this thing, how to provide all these things. You're focused on the party. Well, the feast, peace, offering is designed to be a relationship between you and God. That's different than the burnt offerings, others, which you don't eat, right? Those are different relationships. But there's between you and God, it's a connection between you and God. That connection has to be done in a honorable or holy manner, okay? This isn't just a party. It's not about being a party. It's about your connection to God. And that's how people connect. If you ever notice this, when you break the whole biblical term is breaking bread with someone, you are making a relationship during that meal. However, even the meal could be small. It's a relationship because you're eating it and he or she is eating it as well. When people go out to dinner together, right? It's not because we're both hungry, although you might be. It's because you're making a connection to the person you're taking out to dinner, whether it be your wife or a girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever. It's a connection you're going to. You could just go eat me out of McDonald's and say, hey, I'm hungry, I'll see you later, and go eat and come back, right? It's not about the eating. It's about the connection you make with the individual. Same thing with the peace offerings. It's a connection you're making with God. And so God says, you're making this connection with me, then it has to be done on my terms. Terms are functional for me. You will eat it in a proper manner. You will not consume it over days and days and days, unlike the people around you. So you have these relationships, because this is what being holy is to God. It's not being like the nations around us. So we have this responsibility for offerings. It's not exclusive to peace offerings. Other offerings also can't be to other things. They're all obviously to God as well. But these folks, he uses this as an example because we as human beings benefit from the peace offerings more so by physical eating it, more so than the other offerings. So it benefit as much, right? Because it's just, they're gifts, meaning benefit directly. You might be indirect as far as blessings, but not a direct benefit. So we categorize them and they have this peace offerings being so critical. We also obviously continue on, not like I mentioned before, not every passage in Leviticus 18-20 fall in these categories, but they do fall in a lot of them do. So it continues on from there into honest gifts of the poor, sorry. Reaping the harvest of your land, you will consider people who are not well off. You'll consider them as far as their needs. That's verse 9 through 9 and 10. It's good about reaping the corners or picking the undeveloped twigs or other things that are in your vineyard. The idea being that you will consider those who are not your personal gain. My computer did a little funky thing there. So things are your personal gain. So your personal gain would be your property, your money, your whatever. We're not focusing on ourselves, focusing on sharing with others, which is a New Testament principle as well. We went across that with our apostles also about being communing with one another. And also from Ephesians, to not commune with those who are not of God. We get that too as well. So our Torah says that, and of course our apostles say that. Apostles aren't making the delineation between Jewish and Gentile like our Torah does. It makes the relationship between follower of God and not follower of God, to not make company with people who don't follow God. We have that example as well. So it's just got moved from one category to the other, but the list still exists. So our relationships are also really important as well, obviously, to our categories. Now we have here in verse 11, which bring your attention, is to not deceit. Don't steal, don't deny falsely, and you should not be a liar to his fellow. This is Leviticus 19, verses 11. You should not swear falsely. So in swear falsely in God's name. Note, the four lists up here, sexual, blood, strangled idols, there isn't lying. I see lying up there. Do you see lying being deceitful? Nope, not there. You could try to force into one spot. It's not. It doesn't really belong there. So you can argue it doesn't belong. So if I play then a naive fool, I truly mean that. Naive fool that says, well, these are just the four things I have to do, nothing else. I'm good for the rest of my natural life. I am naive. Okay. Reality is I am supposed to improve, which Ephesians 4 and 5 discuss. And Apostle Paul says, stop lying. In Ephesians 4 and 5. You don't get to lie anymore. No, you be honest dealings with each other at all times, which, because he's saying that in Ephesians 4 and 5, from people who are a little bit more mature in their walk with God as Gentile Christians, say, oh, okay, that means our walk with God is not stopped these four things. We continue on that walk, okay? And how do we learn about lying? What is and isn't lying? Well, in our Torah portion here, we covered about honest weights, honest measures. Those are all forms of lying, you know, dishonest weights, dishonest measures, right? Here's a cup. Well, it's actually 95% of a cup, not a full cup. Well, now you're being dishonest. It may seem like a small amount, but do that 10,000 times. And they have a whole lot of extra that you didn't have to sell and you can keep selling. That's why it's dishonest. The other side is also true as well. You can't say, well, I only took a cup, and in fact, you took a cup and a half. Well, that's also dishonest. So these lying things are also part of our requirements as we move in our walk with God. Hopefully this is not like crazy. It's obviously stuff we understand. But one thing I want to bring out to you is this a phrase in verse 11. You should not deny falsely. Some will say deal falsely. And you should not lie to another. What's the difference between denying falsely and lying? They are not the same thing, by the way, in case you're curious. There are subtle differences, but they are different. Lying, she's going to try to answer it. Lying is not telling the truth. And denying is accusing. Okay. That's a fair example. So she wrote, she's arguing that to lie is to not tell truth. So it's not tell truth. And she said to deal falsely or deceive. What about deal falsely? Because most of your English Bibles will say deal falsely, right? But mine says deny falsely. It's the same thing. Deal falsely. Is to, what'd you say, to leave out? Is that leave out information? What? Somebody accused. Oh, okay. So it's a deny of accusation. That is a fair, though not full, example of that. But these are two different types of things. Lying, we all know what lying is. That's obvious, okay? You're telling somebody something that is false. That is a lie. Now, in the case of, now, what I find interesting to me is, what's that? Or deal falsely. Yeah, you deal falsely or deny falsely. There's two different ways which the Hebrew word could fall under either category. Rose said, can it be a half-truth? That's what we're talking about, actually. So in your Torah, in your the Ten Commandments, don't bear false witness, right? That is traditionally understood, not correctly necessarily, but traditionally understood as applicable to things that are on trial, right? Things that are, here somebody's been accused of some crime, or you're going to accuse somebody of a crime. Those are, you know, be a fair false witness, make a false claim, okay? And we typically have applied that and you should try it to trials, which is really the most critical place because you've got people on the, you know, their lives on the line, or either death or jail time, whatever. So lie, that's pretty obvious. We understand you're not telling the truth. Deal falsely is a little different. So you could argue this, but Jewish tradition has interpreted this phrase to mean either denying a truth or leaving out a truth, to leave out. Because what objective, as Rose pointed out, could it be a half truth? Well, that's the point of the leaving out. So in this instance, and Ephesians 4 and 5, which is also listed as far as telling people the truth, only focus the truth, Ephesians is not isolated to a trial scenario. It's quite obvious. It is across the board, period. You're dealing with other human beings that obviously believe in God to some level. We're not just discussing people who are godless necessarily, although we can discuss that. There's a different topic. But people who believe in some form of a God or believe, being honest to some level, you are responsible for always disclosing the truth. Now, half truths would fall in this category because you left that information. So that's not allowed. You can't do half truths. That's still a lie because you're dealing falsely with someone. What is the objective of a half truth? Either A, to manipulate the other person to thinking or doing something that is to your desire, whether it's your benefit or someone else's benefit. You're doing it for your desire because you want it, right? That's half truth. If you gain nothing from telling the half truth or lose nothing from telling to tell the whole truth, that is, I've been saying whole truth, then there's no incentive for you to tell half a truth. If it's completely to your benefit, you tell all the truth, right? I've got everything out there. And we've discussed this. Leaving out exceeding is like masking or creating a facade. Correct. That's a great point, Carrie. It is pointing out, like, it's making a fake, an incorrect image of yourself or the individual or topic you're talking about, an incorrect image of it in the eyes of the person you're disclosing, you're talking to. It could be about something you've done, something you haven't done, something somebody else did, something the government did, something your friend did or didn't do. It doesn't matter what it is. You're manipulating the scenario to manipulate the other person's mind. That's the goal. You manipulate their mind, you manipulate their action to whatever outcome you want. That is dealing falsely. You may not be spewing out an outright lie. You are concealing information, which leads to the other person or individuals either acting or reacting in a certain way that is to your desire, if you can. That is dealing falsely and is not exclusive to just law and order type of, you know, courtroom scenario. It is a full fact information. Now, what is your alternative means if you are trying to not disclose things that are destructive to you or someone else? I'll give you the classic modern day example. Get the Nazis knocked down your door and say, where you hide the Jews, right? And they may be in your attic, basement, or in the wall, whatever you happen to made. And you could say, well, I can't lie, so they're over there behind the wall. Well, no, that would not be useful, would it? But you are not required to answer them. Silence. I don't know. No, that's a lie. Just silence. You don't have to answer. There's no requirement for you to answer. Yeah, they'll just probably beat you, kill you, torture you, whatever. But look, what's that? Oh, search my house. Yeah, you can say it's just search. It's your business. The point is that you do not have to lie in order to, because by the way, you are representing God at all times. To lie in order to facilitate a particular outcome that you're looking for. God is capable of making an outcome that is independent of you. I know it's shocking, but he has that ability to do things independent of you. Being silent is not lying, nor is it dealing falsely. It's not dealing at all. You're refusing to deal with, refusing to communicate with. That is not fall in the category in either Jewish nor Christian tradition. It is classified as lying. You just keep your mouth shut. There's a reason we have, what's the Miranda right thing? So you have the right to remain silent? Yeah, that's, we have that. You have the right to remain silent, to not incriminate yourself or anybody else. Whether that may not apply to Germany, but that's okay. It does here. The idea is you don't have to tell them anything. So lies and deceit is an inherent problem. And why is that? Why does a God not like those things? because as in verse 12, he points out, you shall not swear falsely by my name, therefore desecrate the name of your God, for I am Jehovah. When you claim or try to claim to follow God and you lie, what did you just do to his name? You may have even lied through by saying, I swear to God, blah, 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 blah. You didn't even said that. Your actions in life, what you claim to follow God, what have you done when you lied or dealt falsely? What did you do to God's name? You're his representative. Imagine an ambassador from, I don't know, some other country, we'll call it, you know, England, just because I'm picking on them for the day. England comes over and lies to our government, which they probably do all the time, but lies to our government about something they're doing. Well, with their representation of their government, which is what their job is, what is our government going to interpret this representative is saying, and that this person is lying to them? That means the government of England is lying to them, right? That's the interpretation. Therefore, if you represent God and you lie, what have you done to the person who's listening to you? You just now told them, hey, God lies too. Whatever's convenient, he'll lie. Thanks, Islam. That's basically what Islam teaches. So it's not a very pleasant scenario. So God does not appreciate liars and that nature. We also have, obviously, because he's on these examples in our categories of, in our Torah portion, we have, it goes into stealing in the form of withholding wages. This is all about, obviously, we won't have a list of idols, strangled blood, etc. Doesn't list stealing. But it is under Moses' law. You don't get to steal. So that is it. As we continue on in our Torah portion, we understand that there's nuances to not just the four categories the apostles gave, which there's a few of them in here. There's nuances to this progression of being an honest individual, which Ephesians advocates for. Curse the deaf, verse 14, and the blind. Obviously mistreating people because God sees, even though you don't, you perceive you can't get in trouble. That's also a form of deceit. I know it sounds strange, but it's also deceitful as well. So it's also a form of lying. If I put a stumbling block on a blind person, I have deceived them. Now, I may think it's funny, ha, 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 because they fell down and hurt themselves. You know, poor, worthless blind person, right? Not that I would do that, but the point is that's the idea. You've made something where they'll never find out that I did it. That just got knocked over. It's their own problem, right? They'll get their own injuries. But again, I'm also now deceiving the blind person. I am, because I did deceive them. I tricked them into falling over. So the deaf person, I've tricked them. I'm cursed. They can't hear me, but I'm cursed anyway. So I'm also, the God is still hearing me. I'm still acting in a deceitful manner. I'm not being an honest individual, right? So those are still classified as being a lying or denying falsely. When it comes to workers' wages idea, you are also denying the worker their rightful ownership. You are personally gaining, you're personally holding on to the money. It'll be pennies worth of interest, but you're still holding on to it. It's all about deceiving or not being honest with the people. No, but deceiving honesty is not listed again as on the idols, strangled things, blood, or sexual immorality. They just aren't. Why? Because they are listed in Ephesians. That means it's a progression thing. You do improve your walk with Ephesians as you progress in your Gentile Christian walk. Perversion of justice, verses 15, which is also a type of deceiving people. And do not show favor to the poor or the great. With the righteous, you shall seek your just your fellow. Gossip monger, that's also listed. That's listed in Ephesians as well. We do not gossip. Do not speak about other things or other people in a negative fashion because you are a peddler of garbage. You're selling the idea that garbage comes out of your mouth. Ephesians argues against that. You don't do that. You don't speak evil of other people to the hearing of others. You should not stand by your fellow's bloodshed. We won't cover all these details. We'll go through some of these a little faster. I'm going to jump down to a verse I want to drag your attention to. You should not hate, verse 19. You don't hate your brother in your heart. You should reprove your fellow and do not bear sin because of him. What does that sound like? Don't hate your brother in your heart. Because 1 John chapter 4, what's the rule there? If you hate your brother, you don't love God. Period. End of story. Hatred in your heart is the opposite of knowing God. That's a tough one. We hate a lot of things. But hating the person is important. We do not do. So the apostles were also arguing the same principle. Jesus said it's also in Matthew 5 about the hate. If you hate something, hate someone, then you are judging. You're basically judging as if God is judging this individual to hatred. And if you hate somebody, then you don't love him. You really don't understand God at all. You may claim to follow God, you don't actually follow God. So hatred is an important thing. Now, is hatred listed up here under idols, strangled, blood, sex? No, it's not listed there either. Hatred is a feeling and emotion. So it's not listed in these categories. So we have some of these, as I mentioned before, some of these Torah lists are within these categories for Gentiles of all, and some, however, are in the more mature Gentile category, which of course Ephesians and John talks about. We didn't go to John 4, but First John 4 is where it lists the hatred and such and love of God. It's First John 4:20, in case you were curious about that. How instead of hating them, you're supposed to admonish them. What does admonish mean? Any guesses? Have you heard of it? Any kid by kids know what the word admonish means? Reprimand? Oh, correct. For what objective? That's the trick. Admonish has an objective, not just reprimand and correct alone. What's the objective? Jesus. Jesus will not do it again. That's great. So admonish, write that up here. We're admonish. Its function is not just to correct, but admonish function is also to improve. You point out someone's flaws, sin, mistake, that's useless. If you point their flaws, mistake, and say, okay, this is what you did, now here's how we fix it, and this is how we improve, now you've admonished them without wickedness or evil or anger. You didn't get angry at them or hate them for it. You admonish them, you said, hey, here's a problem. This is what you're doing, which shouldn't be done, or this is what I'm doing, which I should not be done. Now I'm going to do this, try to improve the scenario. I am now helping my brother. So we don't hate them. We don't hate the sinner. We don't hate the individual who's failing. We admonish them. Okay, so I can't, as God points out, as most put out, if I hate, I don't love God. Well, I do love God, therefore I can't hate. When someone's doing something evil, what do I do about it? You admonish them instead. Instead of hating them, you admonish them. This is what you must, not must. So this is what you can improve or help this person along their walk, help this person along their travels and experiences to improve their actions. These are pretty straightforward stuff. Nothing really complicated here. Let's move on forward, shall we? Don't take revenge, no grudges. I'm not going to go through all the grudges. Observe decrees, not make so animals and others. Mixing of animals and seeds. So this comes from our Amos chapter 9. Let's do Amos chapter 9 real quick on that one liner. Do not mix seeds. Let's go to Amos, which was read. Hold on. Amos is a smaller book. Your question about mixing? Go ahead. What's your question? Mixing clothing, different fabrics, right. The mixing of fabrics. Let's talk about that real quick, since you brought it up. My other marker is my orange marker for this. So when we race, I admonish real quick, as I discuss these mixing of fabrics, we have mixing of seeds, which goes in Amos 9. We'll talk about it because that's where it's brought up. That's where it's brought up in a practical, real life sense. Okay. So, and Samara's question is about fabrics. About mixing fabrics, right? Because we have the mixing of seeds, mixing of animals, mixing of fabrics. And it points out, specifically our Torah is very explicit. It always uses the example of linen and wool as to not mix those fabrics. Now, that's modern day terminology, modern day being English terminology from like 200 years ago, a linsey woolsey fabric, right? It's a mixture of linen and wool woven together. Now you will find in our Torah, we do have examples of linen and wool mixed, and they're on priestly garments, but they aren't woven together. Okay, so in the case of our Torah, linen has to be linen, and wool has to be wool, and they can be worn at the same time, but they cannot be mixed inside of intermingling fabrics, right? You don't get to mesh together in a fabric format. I can have, for example, a cotton shirt and a wool overcoat, for example. Pretty common, right? Nothing wrong with that because they didn't mix the fabrics together. In the Torah, the priestly garment does have, I think it's the sash, weaves together wool and linen in the sash. Like, isn't that prohibitive? Yeah, for you. There's only one item that was allowed to be mixed together, and that was a priestly garment, and nobody else gets to wear it except the priest, the high priest alone. So there are scenarios where we don't fully understand the reasoning behind the mixture, because we just don't. I don't. Nobody else does either. We have understandings of a little bit, but not a whole lot. You will also find that in our modern day fabrics, you'll see like polyester, for example, right? Lots and lots of polyester in our fabrics. And they have, you know, mixes of rayon and, which is could like half dozen plants make rayon. You have cotton, excuse me. You've got obviously linen. You have wool, and they mix fabrics all the time. So, in a Jewish instruction or thought comprehension level, they say you could not wear those items because they're in fact mixed. On the other hand, they do tolerate same plant material mixtures in some sects of Judaism. For example, if I mix linen and cotton, they will tolerate that sometimes because they're both hefty plants. Not all of them agree to that, but some agree to that. Yes. What was that? Wool shreds linen. Yeah. Yeah. If you do wear wool linen, they don't last long together. So they tend to cut each other because wool is a very, linen's a very hard fabric and wool is a softer one, and they can degrade or fall apart from each other. It's kind of a deceitful fabric. So it can look that good, but it's really not that useful to you in a real practical sense. Now, back to your question about the clothing you wear for work. You may have a cotton polyester blend. That's like the most common fabric I think there is about cotton polyester blends for people to wear. And as far as our Torah is concerned, it doesn't talk about polyester. It's not listed. That's petroleum. So we can argue what that necessarily means. Someone argue it's an animal product. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And then a cotton product, of course, is a cotton product. I can't tell you what's right or wrong. I just can't. Because we only have the given list of linen and wool specifically. We can argue, does it only apply to linen and wool, or does it apply universally to everything else? I can't answer that question. I don't think anybody else can either. So I don't have a good answer for you. You could make your own clothing. Yep. You could. That's a 100% thing. Lindsay, you have a question? Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hi. I just wanted to add to what you were saying about the linen, and because of the technologies that we have today, that it shows that linen is actually a high frequency material, and it's also antibacterial. I think it's antimicrobial. And so there were studies, I guess a long time ago, all the hospitals used to use linen sheets, and it would aid in people's healing recoveries. But due to the systems, they have been deliberately trying to lower our frequencies, I guess, and make us unwell. They've removed the linens from the hospitals. And so that's one of my beliefs. And like the plastic, like you were talking about the polyester and stuff, part of us being so disconnected from the earth and its natural, when you ground using leather or bare feet, your body is in a more natural state and able to fight off these viruses and bacteria more efficiently than when you're not grounded. And so linen and like plastic interferes with that. And so does all like the 5G and all that.
Right. I have heard about that as well. For a number of years, I don't think they do anymore. My mother was making a linen business for the exact reason. The idea was that the more linen products you have, the higher, it's like 500 hertz. Yeah, it's good. They called their company Wholesome Vibrations for years. They sold it to somebody who's doing it now. But yeah, the exact same principle. Linen, when you mix I know this is getting a little bit outside of our Torah understanding, but when you mix certain fabrics together, or any products together, those of you who do the engineering work, which is where my world is, different products have different abilities to conduct electricities, as well as other products too. They can do just electrical conductivity, thermal conductivity. There's also like silicon chips, the non-thermal and then thermal electric. It jumps around a little bit, but each of those items have their properties. When you mix them in a right order or wrong order, you get a different outcome. And if metals work that way, I already know metals do, all minerals do. We know gases work that way, from helium to hydrogen to oxygen, they all different things, how you mix, what mix you put together. It is not crazy to think that plants work that way too. We do know animals do. Have you seen a mule? You got a donkey and a horse, you get a mule, right? And the mule's not as good as either one. They have their defunct properties as a result. So when you mix things together, you have problems show up. So, and I do recall, I don't quote me on this, but I do recall you're mentioning you about the plastic products making interfering with those capabilities. Yes, I think they do. For concrete, they think cotton is neutral. Cotton like has no conductivity on it. That's why they used to use it for dielectric material in capacitors, but I digress. In the case of other products, they don't conduct well, and they can mess with the conductivity of other things, including plastics can as well. So they have their function as far as why you wouldn't necessarily want to mix fabrics. And they also have their function to useful function, different opportunities, depending on the scenario. So mixing fabrics is inherently not what the Torah intended. The Torah didn't have polyester, didn't have oil products, petroleum-based products in its lists, but the idea of mixing fabrics really wasn't the intention. The only reason we can even do oil-based products is because we have modern technology can make thread out of polyester. You couldn't do it more than 200 years ago or 150 years ago. So there's a lot of differences. We have another comment here about Dinette Williams. She said, didn't God say he made all things clean? No, he did not make all things clean. The only things which he made clean are things he listed as clean. So for example, many animals are unclean. We already know that. That's crabs and lobsters and snakes and lizards, various other things. There's a lot of unclean things he made. He also did not make human poop clean. It still remains unclean. You clean your substance. Not everything he made is clean. He did say everything has a purpose, but not everything is necessarily clean. So you have a translation judgment from Mark 7. Oh, right. That is a comment from Mark 7. So there is a translation error on one of the passages in our New Testament that is not specifically talking about all things being made. That's going a little bit outside of our discussion matter, but not all things are made clean in as far as God didn't make them that way, and Jesus did not change that. Now, there is a difference between making human beings clean in the form of ritual clean, because we inherently are unclean. Because if you ever checked our bodies, we are not like the clean animals. We're very unclean. So he points out that there are things which you can do to make yourself ritually or spiritually clean or unclean. And those are action-based items. Let's move forward a little bit further, because the love your neighbor thing, as you've run across that numerous times in our Bibles, as far as love your neighbor as yourself, that's quoted a few different ways about, loving. You shall, the verse 18 of chapter 19. So you shall not take revenge, you shall not bear a grudge against members of your people, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Jehovah. One of the greatest things that Jesus reiterated from our Torah, that you love your neighbor as yourself. That's an important principle. It's not something that Jesus made up. He's restating what the Torah already commands. Hope we're going pretty slowly here. Am I already past time? I am past time. Dang it. Bummer. Okay, rush through real quick, because I want to talk about our mixed things. We're not going to do the carnal lie with woman. Yeah, that's all the sexual sins. That's verse 20 through 22. The land, plant food trees. Yep, fruit forbidden and such for 3 years. That's a. We're not going to discuss that too much because I want to cover one thing. Let's because we're going to mix seed thing, our mixed fabric thing, right? Let's jump to Amos 9, because that's just where we get a glimpse as far as what God's talking about, okay? So this is Amos 9 about the whole mixed thing. Let's focus that real quick. The tail end of Amos 9, I'm going to focus on verse 11 through, oh, hold on. Got my volume thing turned down. Verse 11 through the end of that chapter of Amos 9. On that day, I'll raise up. This is about the house gets sifted, so they're all get cleaned out. I will raise up the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and repair its damages. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the Gentiles who are called by name. That's verse 11 and 12 of Amos 9. When it says the Lord who does this thing, Gentiles called by his name. What is that? Gentiles called by his name. Think about that. When Amos was being written, were there Gentiles called by God's name? The answer is no, there were not. So don't even bother trying to search. They weren't called by his name. So Amos is pointing out Gentiles called by God's name. Oh, Acts 19. Okay, we'll discuss Acts. I'll go to Acts in a minute, right? Acts 10, because Danette brings up a question about Acts 10. Just call by his name. Gentiles, how does a Gentile get called by God's name? That's a change. It's a change from being not called by God's name, but to be called by God's name. That's the difference, right? Change from one state to the state, or the one condition or the condition. So called by God's name, which actually Acts 10, since that brings that up, we'll go to Acts 10 real quick, his example of one. Acts 10, it says, the great sheet, right. The next day, as they went on their journey, drew near the city, Peter went on the housetop, to pray about the sixth hour, that he became very hungry and wanted to eat. This is Acts chapter 10. Yep. Acts chapter 10. While they were made ready, he fell into trance, saw heaven open up, and dropped a great sheet round about the corners, descending from him to let down the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him and says, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And a voice spoke to him, saying again, "Same time, what God has cleansed, you must not call common." And this is done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. Now Peter was wondering within himself what this vision meant, he had seen. Behold, the men who had been sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate. And they called and asked whether Simon's, whose surname was Peter, was lodging there. While Peter thought about the vision, the Spirit had said to him, "Behold, three men are seeking you. Arise, therefore, go out and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them." Then Peter went down to the man who had been sent to him from Cornelius and said, "Yes, I am he who you seek. What reason have you come?" And they said, "Cornelius the centurion, a just man who fears God and has a good reputation among all the nation of the Jews, which was divinely instructed by a holy angel to summon you to his house and hear words from you." Then Peter invited them in and lodged them. On the next day, Peter went with them, and some brethren from Joppa accompanied him. And the following day, they entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. As Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter lifted him up, saying, "Stand up, I myself am also just a man." And as he talked with them, he went in and found many who had come together. Then they said, "You know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or go to one house of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Therefore, I came without objection as soon as I was sent for. I asked then, for what reason have you sent for me?" He says, "4 days ago, I was fasting until this hour, and the ninth hour, I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in a bright clothing. He said, 'Cornelius, your prayer has been heard. Your alms are remembered in the sight of God. Send therefore to Joppa and call Simon Simon here, whose name is Peter. He is lodging in the house of Simon, a tanner, by the sea. When he comes, he will speak with you. So I sent it to you immediately, and you have done well to come. Now, therefore, we are all present for God to hear all things commanded to you by God. So in this story, we have a quite obvious example that the unclean clean is discussing human beings. So it's quite obvious the image that he's given with this whole sheet coming down, God is giving him an image of vision to say that human beings, which God has cleansed, are clean, versus the human beings who God has not cleansed. So God has cleansed human beings. They are not no longer common. They are now a Gentile by God's name. Hence Amos 9, Gentile by God's name. So Danette, when you were discussing your question about making things clean, it is very explicit. Peter, it gives us the entire understanding. It's the interpretation, understanding that the animals, you have clean animals and unclean animals. Clean animals represent, obviously, Israelites, because God said, you'll be clean, you'll eat clean animals. So the people of Israel. Unclean animals, God said he gave to the Gentiles to eat. So the unclean animals represent Gentiles. So you have the sheet coming down with unclean animals, which means Gentiles are in the sheet. He's saying, go eat, consume, not to eat human beings, but the idea is that this is going to be clean. I'm cleaning the Gentiles. So Gentiles now be called by my name. Of course, Peter then does his preaching and the Cornelius' house obviously becomes part of the followers, the Gentiles by God's name. So that brings us back to Amos 9, which is the same topic, right? Nothing really changes. God kind of has a repeat button over and over and over again. So in this case, Amos 9 discusses this Gentiles by God's name, right? And so, well, what are those? Well, Cornelius is a great example. Here is now a Gentile by God's name, right? Because he's now included. And this king of David, or this descendant of David, they'll be ruling over that Gentile group, as well as the people of Israel. So that they're all grouped together. And this word thing is very fascinating. Verse 13 and 14. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord of Amos 9, by the way, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes, him who sows seed, the mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with it. That sounds great, right? And I'll bring back the captives of my people, Israel. Nope, that's not the Gentile by God's name. This is Israel's captives. So Israel, and they will build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them, and they shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them. I will plant them in their land, and no longer shall they be pulled up from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. Here is my map. I'm going to erase this a little bit because this is a cool part. A small map. I'll put it over here, actually. So those of you who know where Israel's at, it makes this funny little shape, kind of like a funky spear, you know, like a spearhead. It goes off to you have Sinai over here, Israel's over here. You got Syria on this side, and you got, Jordan's over here, big J for Jordan. I'm not going to draw all these maps, these modern day countries, but yeah, Lebanon way up top. That's the basic map of Israel. Well, if you notice that the David's rule or territory that he and his descendants, so we would be Jesus, would rule, obviously you have Jerusalem sitting here right here in the middle. But he also has to rule the Gentiles called by God's name. And this interesting part to me is because in Ezekiel, the 43, I think it's 44, 45, it's 45, discusses that Gentiles called by God's name get inheritance with Israel. So they get to inherit the same land Israel owns, the Israelite tribes own. And as Ezekiel points out, whatever tribe they hang their hat on, well, they use the word hat, but whatever tribe they attach themselves to, they inherit with that tribe. So when Messiah David, David's descendant, reigns, he's reigning over Israel as he lists in Amos 9, but also the Gentiles under God's name. So this territory of Israel, I'm going to call this all in, which actually includes part of modern-day Jordan and Syria. They may not like that idea, but it's true, it does. It's going to include Israelites, which God just lists out here, he's going to bring back, but it also includes the Gentiles by God's name, which includes Cornelius and anybody else who happens to follow God. Why? Because they're clean. They're, as what I've made clean, don't call it unclean. Gentiles are no longer unclean if they are called by my name, I mean, if they're following what I am instructing them to do. And this is where the mixed seed comes in, Samara. How does a king rule two different types of people following two separate laws? Napoleon Bonaparte tried. And what happened to Napoleon Bonaparte? All the nations that came out. So when you, if you have mixed seed, mixed peoples that don't follow the same set of rules, what happens? Bad things happen, right? It doesn't work that way. If you have a king ruling two mixed peoples, they don't function together. They have a funky, weird, blended mix that's not cohesive and doesn't work well. Those of you who read the book of Esther, what was Haman, what was his biggest thing? Hey, Ahasuerus, or how you pronounce the guy's name, there's a people group that don't follow our laws. They can't be here. It doesn't work right. And Haj says, oh, okay, kill them all off, right? It was a dumb story, but the point is, that's what he argued. You can't have two people groups under two different sets of laws being ruled by the same king, the same set of laws. It doesn't work that way. Hey, laws apply to you for thee, not for me. How's that supposed to work? It doesn't work. So the idea is, when you call by God's name, you are now incorporating yourself into the Jewish or Israelite identity, not as a replacement, but as an add-on, as Ezekiel explains. You are grafted in as a part of, not a replacement of, but a part of. That's how they attach. That's how they blend together. So Cornelius then could be included in, all of his family who were baptized, as well as many others the apostles had baptized, both Jewish as well as Gentiles who were baptized. They have the same rules, same instructions, which the Apostle Paul reiterates in Ephesians as well as Corinthians, that there's expectations of obedience. And of course, Acts 15 discusses extensively about the whole, you will follow these idols, strangled blood, sexual morality issues in order to show up at Shabbat, in order to learn the rest of Moses' laws, to change your behaviors, so we follow the same laws. The idea is to bring the Gentiles into God's name category, into being part of the entire list, which was the objective all along with Moses. You're supposed to be an example to the world around you. There's nothing shocking here, but these laws that are written here in Leviticus, which obviously I didn't get to chapter 20 at all, really, but the more sexual sins in chapter 20, these are all designed to make you closer and closer and closer and closer to God. They are initial steps, how we conduct ourselves, this whole idols and strangled things and blood and sexual morality. They're your initial baby steps. And from that point forward, you move forward in your walk with God. As Ephesians points out, this is what righteousness looks like. You improve your walk with God by following more and more of Moses' instructions. Don't start there immediately. It doesn't work that right off the bat. It's a progressive thing as you mature in your Christian walk. Cornelius was called a righteous individual, a righteous Gentile, a righteous centurion, based on what condition? Because he said so? No, his actions showed it. He was acting in a righteous manner according to what Judaism would respect or honor as righteous, which is the laws of Moses. They're all pretty much the same overall story. It's as Jeff points out, when you push the print button, you expect the printer to work, and God puts print button over and over and over again to retell you the same story. The idea is, our conduct matters. To be holy, as chapter 19, verse 1 and 2 said, be holy like God is holy, is how we conduct ourselves. We start out from the basics, the whole idols and strangled and blood and sexual morality prohibitions, and we progress from there to go walk in our walk, to be included in Ezekiel's list of people who are included in the inheritance of Israel, and be part of your tribe, part of your God, because you are now called by God's name. And as Amos points out, the seed of David will rule all of us in the same set of laws, same rules, same conditions. We're all in the same laws to where it functionally works to people. I am way, way over time. So any comments or questions regarding this? I'm sorry I didn't get very far in Leviticus 20, but sometimes, you know, that unfortunately happens. Any comments or questions beyond this? Hopefully I answer your question, Danette, regarding how Peter explained what that vision was, and how you as a Gentile, I as a Gentile, become part of the people of God and become a part of that Gentile called by God's name It's our conduct. It had nothing really to do with food. It had to do with the human beings being discussed. Hopefully it made sense. Any comments or questions or opinions? And hopefully it made sense on planting the seeds tomorrow regarding the mixed seeds and such. You can't have mixed people.
Yeah, Daniel?
Yes.
Yeah, one way to explain the issue of the laws is, let's pretend you have a man who has two daughters. The older daughter is responsible. She's very diligent. She's very clear-minded. So the father gives her stricter rules and training to maybe prepare her to be the heir of the house. But the younger daughter, maybe she's more flexible, carefree, so he doesn't put those laws on her. He gives her maybe different rules. He doesn't let her totally run crazy, but he does have different rules for the younger daughter. Well, what's going to happen? The older daughter may resent the fact that the younger daughter doesn't have the strict rules, and she would prefer to follow the younger daughter's rule book. The younger daughter realizes that dad respects the older daughter and puts more rules on her. And when she excels at those rules, obviously the father is proud of her. And so she wants to try to follow the older daughter's rule book, and maybe doesn't do so well because she hasn't had the training to be able to follow that rule book. And so both of them don't want to follow the rules they were given. They want to follow the rules the other one was given. And it causes chaos. So what should you do? You give them rules and guidance that they all can follow, and they'll be successful. And they won't resent each other, and they won't say, well, dad favors you because you have stricter rules. No, dad favors you because you have no rules. It's chaos. So
it is chaos. It doesn't work.
If you give them all the same rules that they both can follow, and when they fail, they have the same consequences.
Same consequence, yep.
They grow up to be stable, normal human beings.
Right. Pretty simple. That's well put. Thank you, Tammy. That was great. That's a great example. There's a single set of rules at work. It doesn't have to be super complicated all the time. Those of you who look at the laws regarding the priests, right? A lot of them are more strict than those who follow everybody else. Well, priests have a specific task that they're unique, and people hated them. I mean, look at Korah, was envious, right? Even in that category, even separating out that simple of a rule category, even that made jealousy and anger and bitterment.
Human nature, huh?
It is human nature, right?
I just wanted to tell you that. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you done? I'm sorry. I just wanted to tell you what a great, wonderful job you did today. It was very good. Could hear you clearly. And we appreciate your teaching. Thank you.
Sure. I didn't get to where I really wanted to talk about later on, which was in chapter 20, the national responsibility for abortion laws, but that's a whole different topic. I was gonna be fun with that one, but I ran out of time because that's a fun thing. See, the comment here, it says, I would say modern day Christians have separated themselves from Jewish identity. If those grafted in are incorporating it, that doesn't seem to be the case. Considering the wave of anti-Semitism right now, the Holocaust, celebration of pagan Easter, etc. Thanks much. Actually, you have an excellent point, Danette. So this is a phenomenon that Isaac has run across, and a few of my kids have. Their generation has become, not all, but an abnormally large percentage become very anti-Semitic. And I was quite surprised to run across that. And it's growing, and it's really bizarre. It could be jealousy. That could be. Oh, Samara's pointing out. She talked to him. They're jealous. What? Because Israel's God's firstborn. That's true. Israel's God's firstborn. And he saves them. He calls them his favorites. Yeah, I can see that. Hey, that comes back to Tammy's quite a point. it's a jealousy going on. So it's really interesting that has happened and grown because I grew up obviously a number of years ago, and we were still in the wave or repercussions of the Holocaust and how awful it was, and being pro-Israel was like, if you weren't pro-Israel, you weren't Christian, type of concept. And if you were Christian and claimed not be pro-Israel, you were obviously, you know, the son of a devil practically. So that's how that worked. And now it's totally shifted. And there is, I can see a jealousy going on, some bizarre viewpoint. You have a favoritism and a hatred of the favored person, favored body group. It's really interesting. And so you have an excellent point. There is a shift occurring at least amongst generation, probably, you know, mid-20s and lower, that is shifting toward a bizarre hatred, animosity and anger toward Israel and even God to some level too. It's kind of a weird thing that's been mulling around and growing without me paying attention to, not that I have any control, but it's really quite alarming in my worldview. Maybe it's not yours, but it's my worldview is very alarming.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hillel.info.